And it's been pretty amazing the way they've been commemorating both the COVID plague and the Black Lives Matter movement. So Greg Palast, TextCast. I'll have to excerpt TextCast. It's a easily available podcast. The first part is really astonishing to my mind. Naomi Fowler, the host of the show, did some research, and she found out, we hear a lot about how slavery has a legacy into today, and yeah, right, the Capitol was built by slaves, a lot of the wealth of the nation. She actually found some documentation that shows there's still an economic instrument related to when the crown compensated slave owners for the loss of their slaves. That's the way the crown did it, I guess, thinking of their serfs and their fiefdoms in the old days. They, in their absolutist sense, they thought that slave owners should be compensated for the theft. Of course, they made a lot of money on opium too, the English royalty. Just because the Lurushis talk about it doesn't mean it's not true. Okay, I was looking into trying to do something on Boogaloo. Brown shirts, black shirts, Hawaiian shirts. It's quite an evolution we got going on here. But I couldn't really find anything. I'm light on COVID material today, too. I'm looking at it. And even though we're in a peak, and these people that have these internet-enabled thermometers for people around the nation, they're not fully deployed, but they're predicting that Missouri is going to be a pretty incipient hotspot. I saw another picture of data, which is that the reason why the curve was flattened some was mainly all due to the fact that New York got a hold of it finally a little bit, and the reduction there pretty much accounts for the flattening. So the expansion and exponential possibilities are still there. Okay, that's more than I wanted to talk, but there you have it. Mumia Abu-Jamal's got a longer essay, and we're going to kick it with them like we usually do. If I can find my way back to the right computer. I'm on computer one because there was some talk about how there was so this hour interval will be, I'll be operating from another computer if somebody needs to get in and do some work on the rest of the morning show or into the afternoon, which should probably be Gina. All right, another women's movement.
The other women's movement. In the frenzied aftermath of the police killing and asphyxiation of George Floyd, we have seen the emergence of a remarkable and sustained movement against racism and the state terror of police. As I watch it in wonder and really awe, it occurred to me that the organizers of this new movement are women. This movement, this mass multiracial, not to mention multigendered and many-aged movement, is led by people who occupy the lowest rungs of America's ladder of race and class, black women, mostly very young black women. They have seized the hour and brought forth people from almost every segment of society. They are the nucleus of the Black Lives Matter movement, and they are ringing the bells in the night, warning America and the world that the American house is on fire. They are, to quote the iconic scholar activist Dr. Angela Davis, smarter and better than their elders of the 60s. They are students of history, and they've proven that they are masters of organizing. The issue of state terror against black and poor communities has been thrown on the table, and few, if any, politicians have a meaningful response. Marx and Engels argued that the state is but the executive committee of the rulers, and voila, they have no real answer to this problem that has lasted for generations. So ideas are coming from the movement and fought by politicians. Politicians who allegedly represent the will of the people and the media, or should I say, the corporate media. We're in the midst of a movement, kind of like chilling in the eye of a hurricane, and everything is being shaken, if not removed. What a day. What an hour. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And she does a great job. Rantoul, Wabash Park. I don't know Rantoul much at all, but they're having a 2 o'clock march and rally. They want people to arrive about 1:30 at Wabash Park for the rally. The police are notified, and there are some speakers. Somebody back in town. It looks like a African-American-led event. So that's 2 o'clock in Wabash Park. Okay, going to move right along. I have lots of things to get to. Amy Goodman, I actually haven't heard this commentary, but I did hear her interview this week through with the, oh my, that's not it. Okay. All right, little snafu on the playback here, open file. I'm on a different computer, as I mentioned. There we go, I guess we'll be able to do it this way. Listen to her interviews with the guy that cooperates with Dave Zirin on a podcast about politics and sports. I'm pretty sure he'll be featured here. And now we are cooking with gas.
For many athletes, challenging racism is no game. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan, our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Rebellion is growing from Minneapolis, where demands to defund the police radiate globally from the site of George Floyd's murder, to cities nationwide where monuments to Confederate generals, colonizers, and others are being torn down. Some decry this onrushing change. Corrupt police unions dismiss the violence their members wreak with impunity on the civilians they swore to protect, and diehard defenders of the long-dead Confederacy continue to wave its battle flag, forgetting that the last flag flown by the generals they worship back in 1865 was the white flag of surrender. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocks any meaningful police reform legislation. While politicians drop the ball, current and retired professional athletes are stepping up, adding momentum to this historic moment. The power of the Black Lives Matter movement recently surfaced at no more unlikely a venue than a NASCAR racetrack. Darrell Bubba Wallace Jr., the only African-American driver in NASCAR's top races, appeared at a race on June 7th wearing a T-shirt reading, "I Can't Breathe, Black Lives Matter." Later, Bubba Wallace said on CNN,
"No one should feel uncomfortable when they come to a NASCAR race. So it starts with Confederate flags. Get them out of here. They have no place for them."
The following day, Wallace drove a car emblazoned with the hashtag Black Lives Matter and peace signs made of interlocking hands of every color. The car's hood read Compassion, Love, Understanding. Hours before the race started, NASCAR issued a statement that read in part, "The display of the Confederate flag will be prohibited from all NASCAR events and properties." Sadly, within a week, what looked like a noose was found in Wallace's garage at the Talladega Super Speedway in Alabama. NASCAR alerted Wallace. The FBI was called in to investigate. On Sunday, a small airplane flew above the Talladega racetrack, towing a large Confederate flag and the slogan, "Defund NASCAR." The Sons of Confederate Veterans took credit for the racist stunt, attributing it to their Confederate Air Force. On Monday, Wallace's competitors and their pit crews pushed his car to the front of the line of race cars in a gesture of solidarity. The FBI later announced its conclusion that the noose was an innocent garage pull-down rope in place since at least October, long before the garage was assigned to Wallace, and thus not evidence of a hate crime. Wallace responded on CNN.
What was hanging in my garage is not a... It's not a garage pool. Whether tied in 2019 or whatever, it was a noose.
Etan Thomas played in the NBA for 11 years until 2012. As a player, and now in retirement, he has never shied away from political activism. With sports journalist Dave Zirin, Thomas co-hosts The Collision, where sports and politics collide, on Washington, D.C.'s Pacifica radio station WPFW.
But the part that was really impressive to me is, number one, the way that NASCAR immediately rallied around Bubba Wallace.
That's Etan Thomas speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
They did more in, 48 hours than the NFL did for, Colin Kaepernick for 4 or 5 years.
Colin Kaepernick is the African-American star NFL quarterback who protested racism and police brutality by kneeling during the national anthem. He played until the end of the 2016 season, after which no NFL team would sign him. He has not played professionally since. Kaepernick filed grievance alleging collusion among the team owners, which he settled in 2019. Across the sports world, athletes are speaking out, risking their careers. Renee Montgomery of the WNBA, that's the Women's National Basketball Association, is taking the shortened season off to support Black Lives Matter, tweeting, "There's work to be done off the court in so many areas in our community. Social justice reform isn't going to happen overnight, but I do feel that now is the time," she tweeted. Kylan Hill, a star running back at Mississippi State University, threatened to leave MSU's football program unless Mississippi removes the Confederate battle flag component from its state flag. And revered NBA legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, in an impassioned opinion piece in the Los Angeles Times, wrote, "Racism in America is like dust in the air. It seems invisible, even if you're choking on it, until you let the sun in. Then you see it's everywhere. As long as we keep shining that light, we have a chance of cleaning it wherever it lands. But we have to stay vigilant because it's always still in the air," he said. Retired basketball star Steven Jackson has been front and center at the protests in Minneapolis. He was friends with George Floyd in Houston and calls himself Floyd's twin because they look so alike. George Floyd loved basketball and should have had many more years to enjoy the game, to enjoy life. For us, the living, still able and obligated to fight systemic racism and police brutality, the ball is in our court. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Well, Amy's waxing a little poetic there, too, it seems like, or it's a person she was citing. Great crafted essay, Breaking the Sound Barrier, regular feature. Well, they've been real regular getting the election theft, the election crimes bulletin, whatever they're calling it today. It's pretty lengthy, so I'm going to leave it to Greg Palast and Dennis Bernstein. Dennis Bernstein's hosting Camila Bustillo, who has the At the Border Facebook page. It's quite informative. And they're talking about something that I didn't know happened. I mentioned that the poem is year anniversary yesterday of that famous photo of father and daughter who drowned in the Rio Grande. He mentions also in the lead up to the poem that one of the things inspired him to write the poem was this absolutely awful closed Facebook group that the Border Patrol was running. He'll tell you about that. But my run-in with that was this Tim Hendricks. Is it Tom Hendricks? I haven't looked him up in a while. He's the guy that crafted or at least circulated a absolutely atrocious post showing Trump humiliating AOC. I put it up and eventually took it down because it was awful. But he's dropped out of the news. I thought he would probably just take early retirement, but probably he's still on the force in this whole Facebook group. Maybe they found another way to not get caught doing their horrible things. So Martin Espada waxes quite poetic on it, intensely so, and I'll get it on if I start this up now. More likely, anyway.
I think it's another day. I had a two-week regimen of hydroxychloroquine, and I've taken it, I think, just about 2 weeks. I think it's another day. So, and I'm still here. I'm still here. And I tested very positively in another sense. So this morning, yeah, I tested positively toward negative, right? So, no, I tested perfectly this morning.
He tested positively, but for what, Greg Pounce? Another edition of the Election Crimes Bulletin, and the crimes continue apace, and it appears that the crime scene is expanding. Let's throw Kentucky in there now. Seems like they have something against polling sites.
Well, you know, here's the thing. They found out that, believe it or not, and I don't know how they couldn't, maybe they should have known this in advance, poll workers don't want to die, as it turns out. Most poll workers, if you look at the Election Systems Commission, you have overwhelmingly poll workers over 65. You know, it's kind of an old people's extra pin money game. But most of them decided for the $40 you get for the day that it ain't worth dying. The result is that in Louisville, there was, and I want to make this clear, one single polling station. One single polling station. They sent them to the big stadium in Louisville where you got to bounce around and find out where you're supposed to vote. So this is what's the big story in Kentucky is to look towards what's going to happen in November if this, you know, if the virus continues. And even so, whether people are just afraid, even if we think that it's close to limited, you're going to have big problems. Plus, you've got then the mail-out issue. Mailing out ballots. Over 800,000 absentee ballots were requested by Kentuckians who, again, don't want to die, so they want to mail it in. The problem is that one of the reasons you have lines is that people are not getting their ballots. I just got off the phone a minute ago with Neil Rosenstein, who is the chief attorney, voting rights attorney for the New York Public Interest Research Group. He's been in this game about 30 years of voting rights. And even his daughter, they almost bounced her out of the polls. They gave her a provisional ballot. And you know, this is a chief voting rights attorney, and he couldn't convince them that she's supposed to get the correct ballot. This is happening all over the place, especially with young voters. So you have a tremendous problem with people getting their absentee ballots, and that's the big, big problem, plus getting them back in time. So people ask for ballots, they don't get them in time. You know, as I mentioned last week, the ACLU, the head of the ACLU of Georgia, her husband, Andrew Young's husband, you know, didn't get his ballot until the day after the election. Well, this is happening in Kentucky, and not everyone has a father or a spouse who is a voting rights attorney. Even then, can't save the vote. And you have to understand, it's not anyone's vote. This is especially hitting, apparently, newly registered voters, which are young voters, progressive voters, by definition. And, you know, so it's brutal. They were also asking young people in New York, for example, we talk about racism. You know, and if you're a New York voter and you're young or you're black, I bet you were asked for your Social Security number, your driver's license. But that's not legal. They don't have that ID requirement. But about 67% of young black men get asked for their ID in states that don't require ID. Like that, Dennis?
Let me just jump in here for a second. We're speaking with Greg Palast. This is our weekly edition of the Election Crimes Bulletin. Greg has a book coming out, How Trump Stole 2020. It's really a book about how to prevent him from stealing it. And essentially, it's not really a book about who gets elected. It's not a book against Trump, but it's about, it's really represents many years of Greg's work to defend your vote. And we learn more and more each election cycle about how the right to vote is in grave jeopardy. And oftentimes, people never get a chance to vote. And we're talking about by the millions. We've got a major election coming up, and we see this again and again. Now, in terms of Kentucky, I'm a little confused, Greg, because my understanding is that the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, is from Kentucky. He's got a lot of power in this world. Wouldn't you think if he wanted to make it possible for everybody to have their vote counted, he could make that happen? Doesn't he want to?
One would suspect that he doesn't, because, for example, the GOP of Kentucky and the Republican Secretary of State, who's a McConnell drone, try to create a scrub list, try to remove 175,000 Kentuckians from the voter rolls because of so-called inactivity, claiming that they failed to vote. Which, by the way, in America, you have the right to vote or not vote. But they use this to knock out. They use this to knock out voters by the hundreds of thousands. Here, in this case, it would be 175,000 voters. But a judge did block them from pulling off that stunt for now. So, you know, McConnell has really been trying to put his thumb on that scale because he has another problem. Kentucky, with the new governor, they have let they are now allowing all ex-cons who serve their time to vote. That's about 150,000 people. That will also change the story for November, no question. So, you know, the Republicans are in a bit of a panic in Kentucky. You know, it should be their state, but they just elected a Democratic governor. And so Mitch McConnell does not have a cakewalk here at all. The only thing he can do is try to get those 175,000 voters off that they're trying to remove. Again, he's not trying to win over voters. He's just trying to remove his opponent's voters. You know, and we've gotten so used to this in America that it's just perfectly fine to play games with voter rolls, to play games with people's rights to vote. I am very, very concerned, especially about the mail-in, with getting your ballots on time. So I do encourage people, whatever you do, ask your ballot way in advance for mail-in voting. But I have to say that Andrea Young asked for her ballot 45 days in advance of the election. Her husband still missed the election by a day getting his ballot. So protect your own vote if you're going to vote by mail, and also check the status when you make a request to vote by mail. If you're not getting it within about 3 weeks of the election, you better check, and if necessary, re-register and ask again. They're not going to necessarily tell you that you don't qualify for that absentee ballot.
I'm starting to panic, Greg, because let's see. This is going towards the end of June. The election's in November. There does not seem to be a whole bunch of fuss being made by the movers and the shakers in the Democratic Party or any of the powers that be to be concerned that we just had an election in Georgia, but there were no machines, or they didn't know how to work them, or you know, they didn't know where the machines were, or
40% without a voting machine when the polls open. It's pretty hard to vote if there's no machine there. And plus, they didn't have the backup paper ballots, emergency ballots. Here's, like you say, where is the Democratic Party? One thing we have to be very concerned about that there's been very little discussion on, you do realize that with the DMVs closed because of the virus, when people aren't re-registering or registering their new addresses or registering their license, they're not applying to vote, because at every DMV, every application for a license by federal law has to include an application to vote. So DMV registrations are down by millions. And as you know, voter registration drives, the church drives to register voters, down by millions. And so one of the big problems we have with 16.7 million voters purged, most of whom have no idea they've lost their right to vote, and the massive fall off of new registrations, this is a big, big problem for the Democratic Party, because the new registrations, of course, are younger voters who are, you know, who are Democrats. So, yeah, so what's going to happen? I don't know, but basically don't count on the Democratic Party to save your vote. You save your own, and you agitate for these, for the right to get your ballot and get it on time. But I also, people better be ready to go in and also vote early, like during the week when a lot of these early voting stations are completely empty during the week in the states that have it. I strongly recommend that. I saw dead empty voting centers in California, but on election day it was packed. And why? Because people thought they were going to get their ballot in the mail. If you haven't gotten your ballot in the mail a week before the election, I wouldn't go double or nothing on losing your ballot. It's very, very important that you take care of your vote. But I'm very concerned about the lack of registration drives right now, and the fact that everyone is not getting their ballot who asked for them. In most states, not Kentucky again because it got stopped by a judge, but Georgia, Ohio, many other states, if you're on the inactive list, you can ask for your ballot. They won't give it to you. So you're going to have to make a special request directly to your county clerk or your county elections board.
Is there any kind of concerted, methodical legal action happening at the national level, or at least effectively in some different states? We heard back in the day before Stacey Abrams lost her election to a steal, we heard about a battle back. She started an organization. Is there any hope here, Greg? Because this really is a profound situation. This is an assault on democracy through the back door, or not even the back door. It's the front door. It's a steal in front of all of our eyes.
As you know, the Greg Powell team's been working with providing material to fair fight. There's battles. And even when the Democrats or progressives take over, as in the state of Wisconsin, when Scott Walker got thrown out and the great Mandela Barnes took over as lieutenant governor, picked up the issue of voting rights with a new election board, the election board in Wisconsin is fighting to stop a purge that a right-wing group is suing to be imposed by the courts. So we have this massive new problem that right-wing groups are now suing. And here's a new trick, Dennis. When you ask about, is there positive litigation going on? Very little, but there's a lot of negative litigation. What's happening is right-wing groups like Judicial Watch, which sued the state of Kentucky to create this purge list, they've now gotten smarter, unfortunately, and they're suing counties which simply don't have the money to defend themselves against these billionaire-funded right-wing organizations. So, for example, Wisconsin, there's a group, Will, a right-wing Wisconsin group backed by the super-right Bradley family, which owned and then shut down its factories in Milwaukee. They have been losing suing the state to force the state to remove hundreds of thousands of voters from the voter roll. So now they're moving on to suing small counties to remove people. And these counties, one, some of them are Republican-controlled, and they're more than happy to be sued. Oh, you want us to remove Mr. Jackson here? No problem. He's erased. You know, in other words, they literally want to be sued. It's a legal con that's going on. So some of these counties want to be sued. Others don't want to be sued, but figure they don't have $2 million to defend against some billionaire's posse of lawyers. It's very dangerous stuff. So that's what's happening all over the country, is the attack on voting rolls now at the county level by right-wing groups. And, you know, the number one defense is check your registration, and you may have to re-register twice.
Well, this is the Election Crimes Bulletin. I'm Dennis Bernstein. We do this every week with Greg Palast. Greg Palast is the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, also a film of that name, very powerful about the way in which elections have been stolen in the past, the way it works. Greg has a new book coming out. We're looking forward to that in July, How Trump Stole 2020. And I guess the subtitle is How You Can Steal It Back?
The subtitle is A Hunt for America's Vanished Voters. And it really is, while Trump has stolen it by his cronies erasing the voter rolls and other trickery, we can bust the burglary and take it back. They can't steal all the votes all the time. So I don't want people to get discouraged, but I want people to wake up and stop thinking it's as simple as, oh, I'll just ask for a mail-in ballot. You got to get the ballot to mail it back in. And I don't know how often I can get across that message, but we can bust the burglary. Just take care of your vote.
Well, and of course, you can, if you miss the Election Crimes Bulletin, you can check it on the web at flashpoints.net, kpfa.org, or I believe it goes up on greatpalace.com. Some of them are up there as well. They're up there as a Facebook. We're trying to do everything that we can to call attention to the fact that U.S. elections are, I don't know if they've ever been secure, but they certainly are not secure now. And there are so many levels and ways in which people can lose their right to vote. And clearly, in these times of pandemic and maniac politicians, we need the vote to work. And this is why, Greg, I think it's incredibly important that you're willing to continue to do the Election Crimes Bulletin. And I know people care a lot about it, but they got to do more than just have fun listening, because this is going to be a losing battle. If you didn't like Trump once, you're probably not going to like him a second time. And most of the votes being stolen are, you know, this is the youth, these are people of color. So these are not Trumpites.
No, okay, we have to keep in mind that vote theft is class war by other means. And that means that it's a racial, it's income, and it's also age, because they're going after the young voters. And you know, we have to understand that, they've gotten much better at this stuff. You know, everything from figuring out how not to count your ballot once you put it in. We're just talking again to the chief lawyer for the New York Public Interest Research Group's Voting Rights Project. His own daughter, he had to go in and make sure, for example, that that they were forcing her to a provisional ballot, which, by the way, the chance is almost 50% that the provisional ballot will be thrown in the garbage. And he knew it. But, you know, at a certain point, at least he helped her fill it out so it wouldn't be rejected by things like, she doesn't have a car, so you don't put in a driver's license, they throw away the ballot, you're supposed to put no driver's license. Tricks like that, because they're hostile to counting the vote in the United States for voters of color and for young people. That's just the truth. We still have an apartheid vote counting system, and they will do everything to get in your way. And there were 7.9 million votes not counted or voters blocked in the 2016 election. That's not Greg Palast. Well, it's in my book, How Trump Stole 2020. It's from the United States Elections Assistance Commission, which keeps track of not only our votes, but the votes we throw away, the votes we don't count. And other nations would be flabbergasted to learn that we literally throw away millions of ballots, but they're not of any color. 900% more likely your vote will be disqualified if you're black than if you're white. 900% difference, Dennis. That's an apartheid election. That's what's going on.
Greg, if in terms of being disqualified after not voting for 2 years, is that a state-by-state situation? So have a number of states ratify that? Or is that somehow national law? Well, where does that come from?
It's a nasty little combination of the two. What happened, it started out in Ohio with a vicious right-wing Secretary of State, John Houston, who noticed that Barack Obama won two elections, and they had to get rid of that. So the only way to get rid of, to stop the Democrats from holding Ohio is by simply eliminating voters of color. And so what they did was they started this business of saying, if you miss a couple of elections, and we mail you a postcard, it looks like junk mail. You should see this. In my book, I have an example of it. I mean, it's just junk mail. So maybe 4% of people send it back. If you miss a couple of elections and you don't send in the card, you lose your vote. That was started in Ohio. And so the A. Philip Randolph Institute, for those who know their history, the great, you know, the Sleeping Heart Porters Union, still has a great foundation. They sued. They said, you know, in America, it says right in the National Voter Registration Act, you can't lose your vote if you decided not to vote in an election. So how can you say these people lose their right to vote? They said, oh, we're not saying that they're losing their right to vote. We're saying they left. They left Ohio. Now, Justice Stephen Breyer asked a question that I asked at the time. All these people left Ohio, like 800,000 families left Ohio. Where are the moving trucks? I mean, the highway should be jammed. Route 80 should be unpassable with these people moving around and out of Ohio. So it's a phony. But the court said, yeah, well, if the Secretary of State says you don't return a postcard, that means you moved. That's okay with us. And so then Georgia picked it up. That was the key to Brian Kemp's fake victory over Stacey Abrams. And it's moved. They try to move it now, like I say, to Kentucky to reelect McConnell. They haven't succeeded so far, but just wait. But they are doing it in about 20 other states, almost all of them GOP-controlled states. This is one of the most dangerous things. Now, it sounds small to you. Oh, you missed a couple elections, you missed a postcard. But we're talking 800,000 people in Ohio. And it is not random. This is really dangerous stuff. So it sounds abstruse, but it's not. And unfortunately, most people, because you missed the card, you don't know you've been purged, that you can't get a vote, so you say, oh, I want an absentee ballot. You don't get it. You don't get it because you're not registered. Then you go in, you wait 2 hours in line with your mask on. You get up to the front, they say, well, I didn't get my ballot. And they say, well, that's because you're not registered anymore. Or in some cases, yeah, we mailed you a ballot, so you can't vote now, unless you vote by provisional ballot. We're going to throw that away. Oh, I have been studying vote suppression you know, basically vote thievery, racial vote thievery for 20 years. This is the worst. This is the worst, the worst. And by the numbers, by the effects, these guys have gotten so good at this. And now they've got a Supreme Court on their side, and that's the dangerous thing. I'm very worried, Dennis, that you know, and again, you know, everyone asks, where's the Democratic Party? Forget it. Silence of the Democratic lambs. I can't speak for why the party seems frozen in the headlights except to say, ask for an absentee ballot. That doesn't get you an absentee ballot, and that doesn't protect the vote. But we're going to do it ourselves. You know, you're not gonna, there's no political party that's going to save your vote. You save your vote.
All right. Well, we're going to continue to do our best on the Election Crimes Bulletin with Greg Palast. We're going to do this weekly. This is an election protection operation. We're glad to have Greg along for the ride. He's got a new book coming up, How Trump Stole 2020. It's really disinfectant, if you will, in terms of getting rid of the diseases that are going to steal your vote if you're not careful. We'll leave it there now, but you can check Greg out at gregpalast.com. Greg, we'll talk to you.
Now, the virus that we're talking about having to do, you know, a lot of people think that goes away in April with the heat.
But we have it so well under control.
It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
Now the Democrats are politicizing the coronavirus. And this is their new hoax.
Well, I think treatment in many ways might be more exciting.
You know, we have thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that get better just by, you know, sitting around and even going to work. Some of them go to work, but they get better.
You are an idiot.
All right. Well, you know,
Dennis Bernstein waxed poetic there with the disinfected model. That's the first theme, or well, more recent theme to election. What did he call it there? The election protection mechanism, election theft report, various titles. I played it pretty much weekly when they were doing it, all the way up into the last election for about 4 months. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm talking 2016. And I think it's a good feature. I think there's a new word, which is a deactivated voter. You're an inactive voter if you decided you had something better to do on a Tuesday when it wasn't. Well, maybe you were in a state where everything was already fait accompli, as they say. So that's what they're doing now. 20 states are deactivating voters. Okay, I'm doing some time checks and stuff, and I think we'll go to the tax cast next. I'll be excerpting this on the fly. It's something from the UK. I don't really need to tell you that, because once you hear it, you'll realize that. And There it is. I'm still not trying not to blame my tools here. I'm on a different computer because the other computer was being worked on when I first stepped in. I don't know if anybody's attending to it now, but decided to be on an alternate computer, and not everything works the way. All right, Putting on the Ritz is the theme song. I guess she'll introduce herself. There's a short interview with John Christensen, who's from one of those Channel Islands that's such a tax haven. Maybe that's why he got it in his blood to look for tax justice. The interview with some folks, we won't get to most of it, but the first part is really pretty intense, talking about wages of slavery, the non-wages. And as I mentioned at the top, our host has found an... I'll let her explain it, but basically the legacy of slavery is actually still active in some economic transaction. I haven't looked at it yet. She's active on, Naomi Fowler, that is, active on Twitter. I guess I'll look and see if I can understand what arcane City of the London project she has found. All right, still hoping to get to all of the poem I'll get to Martin Espada no matter what. And I'll play him at the real speed, too, so for once.
Justice for people of color.
States have choices. They have a choice point, and that's to cut services and continue to cut their budgets that harm families that are in need, or raise revenue. Raise revenue on corporations, raise revenue on those that are most profitable and the wealthy. And that's a racialized choice.
We'll look at the United States and how tax justice can help address systemic racism. By the way, there's no research on this that I could find on the UK context. If you know any different, please let me know. Meanwhile, in the news this month, governments around the world are still bailing out companies with few or no conditions as nations try to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. Protesters have been risking their health to fill the streets to stop police violence against and murder of people of colour and to call for deep societal change. And at the same time, in the United States, there's a huge looting process going on since the US administration is refusing to tell citizens which 4.5 million businesses have received $500 billion worth of government bailouts. They say that what they're doing in the name of the public is confidential. That's similar in Britain, by the way, where billions have been granted in bailouts, but almost all of it's hidden from public view. Same situation in other countries too. As we've always said at the Tax Justice Network, companies should at the very least commit to publishing country-by-country reports on their genuine business activities, not using tax havens, not hiding who the real owners are, protecting their employees, making sure there's no shareholder extraction, and you'd think it's obvious, they should be paying fair taxes. Let's talk to John Christensen now with the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, so this month I released research I've been working on for a long time. This is research on Britain's slave owners' compensation loan, and this is when the British government compensated slave owners, not the slaves, after they passed the Slavery Abolition Act in 1833. That debt was only settled by the government in 2015 on behalf of taxpayers, incredibly. And my purpose with the research was to try to identify which financial institutions were involved in restructuring the loan at various points, basically to hit them up for reparations money. And you can read more about my research in this month's show notes. I haven't yet got to the smoking gun to be able to identify those banks and institutions which profited from the loan, but obviously we know already that the City of London and Britain itself built its wealth from slavery and empire. We know still today that the city's finance sector has an extractive business model that impoverishes some of the world's poorest nations. We know financial secrecy is another form of empire. At the same time I released my research, events have obviously moved very fast with the Black Lives Matter movement. We've seen statues in Britain commemorating slave traders coming down. The Bristol slave trader Edward Colston has been toppled. Around the world other statues have been toppled. Many others are now finally being moved to museums to be viewed in their proper shameful context. I didn't think I'd ever see that in my lifetime, to be honest, and I didn't think I'd ever see big finance sector companies coming forward and making apologies. That is what is beginning to happen. We should be extremely sceptical. Some of these financial institutions say they're setting up what they're calling reparations funds to go some way to addressing the terrible injustices that they profited from. The insurer Lloyd's of London is one of them, and several lawsuits were filed against them over the years by descendants of slaves in the US, and those failed. Now they're acknowledging what they should have done, could have done, a long, long time ago. On the funds themselves, we don't have the details yet. We need to make sure, obviously, that these institutions aren't just going to heap more pain on people by making insultingly small charity donations. I mean, how do we make sure that these funds are large and they're targeted in the right place and they're ongoing?
Well, first of all, thanks for your blog, which was an eye-opener. Everyone I know who has read your blog is asking the same question. How did Britain reach this situation where the public was still paying interest 180 years later on a loan taken out in 1834? And why were the slave owners being compensated for the fact that they were forced to stop running a slave economy, but the slaves themselves received no compensation whatsoever? Now, what makes this conversation even more painful is that after the Civil War, a few decades later in the United States, General Sherman issued a special order providing for the freed slaves in the southern states to be granted 40 acres of land. This land was seized from the large Confederate plantation owners. But just months later, after President Lincoln was assassinated, his successor, Andrew Jackson, who, by the way, was a full-blown racist, overturned Sherman's order and blocked the transfer of land. So no compensation from the Brits after they abolished slavery in the Caribbean, and no compensation from the Americans after the Civil War. So the end of slavery just opened up another chapter in the immiseration of black people's lives in America and elsewhere. And many companies and personal fortunes among the white communities were built on slavery and its aftermath. So yes, it's time to have a really serious discussion about reparations and why we need economic justice for black communities. Now, the first thing we need to recognise is that we actually know very little about which banks, which trading houses, which manufacturing businesses were actually involved in slavery. So we need independent audits of the banks involved, and independent historians must play a lead part in those audits and then remedy those injustices, so it must be independent audit-led. Then there needs to be a proper negotiation on what level of reparation should be paid and to whom, and who will be responsible for holding reparation in trust funds for the genuine benefit of the descendants of slaves. What must not happen is that banks and other companies use tokenistic reparation payments as an exercise in whitewashing, while not disclosing the full history of their involvement in slavery or in imperial plunder and pillage. It seems clear that most people in North America and Europe have really very little idea about how much of the accumulated wealth of our nations was built on the back of slavery. For example, very few people in Britain seem to recognise that the Industrial Revolution was built on the backs of slaves picking cotton in the southern states, or picking tobacco, or cutting sugar in the Caribbean region, and so on. Now, this ignorance of history has fueled a total misunderstanding of economic history, which has had consequences right up to the current day, with many people in Britain seeming to want to return to those halcyon days of the British Empire when free trade was imposed by the cannons of the Royal Navy. So it's the consequences of not knowing about history. So I think the former slaving nations, and that includes Britain and France and Spain, Portugal and the United States, now need to do some reparation history, reparative history. Understanding their roles in slavery and in colonialism and in imperialism, and how they looted and pillaged the wealth of other countries, especially in the global south. And I'd like to see some of those reparation payments put towards creating proper museums of slavery, colonialism, and imperialism. however, so that these aspects of our past are properly explained without the usual whitewash. How about using the palatial offices currently occupied by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in London, which was originally built in the 19th century as the India Office? How about turning those offices into the British Museum of Slavery, Colonialism and Imperialism? It would be an ideal location to teach children and adults, of course, about this massively important part of our collective history. And another final thought, for anyone who thinks the looting and the pillage stopped at the end of empire, they need to think again. As the old empire died, particularly in Britain, a new financial empire emerged around the City of London, with a vast spider's web of tax havens spreading from Hong Kong and Singapore through Mauritius, the Seychelles, Cyprus, Channel Islands, Gibraltar, Cayman, British Virgin Islands, and others. And these tax havens allowed the looting and the pillage of the countries of the Global South to continue, just in a different guise. So let's hear no more about the looting being a thing of the past. It isn't, and reparations must also be paid for the more recent plundering.
Yes, and it's obvious that reparations are part of an essential transformation. We need to see significant wealth transfers. And there's also been some work on how a reparations tax on big financial sectors might look in that respect, a kind of financial transactions tax to help get that flow of money, that wealth transfer back to the right places on an ongoing basis. Kevil Baradia has done some work on a super tax on the $8 trillion a day financial markets, and you can find those details in the show notes. But how can we think about combining tax justice and reparations?
You know, there are many good reasons for imposing financial transactions tax, especially since so much of the trading that happens daily on financial markets is more about extracting wealth than creating wealth. So I'm all in favour of a Tobin-type tax, and I think I'd go further in the case of paying for reparations. I also think that at this moment of pandemic, which is really harming poorer countries worse, this is a moment to use some of the money coming from a financial transaction tax to support poorer countries. Inequality has risen to extraordinary levels over the past 40 years, largely because neoliberalism has played this shocking role in increasing inequality, because so much of the agenda was about cutting taxes on wealth and on profits and deregulating markets, especially labour markets. So wealth has become much more concentrated in the hands of billionaires than ever before, and billionaires have seen their wealth increase tenfold. The legacy of centuries of institutionalised racism is that a wealth chasm has been created between black and white communities. Recent research coming out of Duke University in North Carolina has revealed that the average black family with children in the United States owns just 1 cent of private wealth for every dollar that the average white family with children holds. We need to tax wealth, and we need to redistribute significant amounts of wealth towards the descendants of slaves as reparation for the past and present wrongs. I think there's a strong case for supporting Kevil Baradia's idea for a super tax, so I'm all in favour of financial transaction tax and a wealth tax and a super tax on profits. This is what a tax justice agenda needs to look like.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. The writer William Faulkner wrote, "The past is never dead, it's not even past. And many countries are still rooted in the laws made by those who profited from slavery and empire." This month, on the TaxCast, we look at how white supremacy is embedded in the US tax system and how tax justice can help address structural racism. I'm talking to Courtney Sanders and Michael Leachman of the Centre on Budget and Policy Priorities, and also to David Sorensen of the People's Tax Page. This is all about power and about who makes the rules. There's a long history of systemic racism in lots of countries, in Britain as well, just like in the United States. And when you look at all the laws and who made them, the laws that we're still living by, in Britain we call them the landed gentry, or the landowners who made the system work for them. You write, for much of our nation's history, people of colour had little to no power in state legislatures, and white lawmakers could set policies that sustained white dominance. There's a really interesting example, which is the oldest example in the United States, which continues to impact on people of colour today, where, and I'm quoting, "wealthy white landowners in Mississippi demanded and won a constitutional requirement for a 3/5 vote in both houses of the legislature for all state tax increases." Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, sure. The history here is that after the Civil War in the South, the governments, the state legislatures that came into power, they included former slaves and white supporters of the Union cause, anti-slavery, and those legislatures were dealing with a situation where they had immense needs to address. For example, they needed to build school systems for the first time for very large portions of their populations, right? It was a war-torn state. And so what they did was they increased property taxes significantly. The property taxes were the major source of revenue in order to raise the revenue needed to make those investments. Over the decades after the Civil War, as white supremacist former slaveholders came back into power, violently overthrew the Reconstruction-era governments and took power, they put into place new state constitutions that protected their power and were deliberately designed to make sure that it couldn't happen again, that their taxes would go way up. It would be harder for them to raise taxes on the former white slaveholders. One example of this is in Mississippi. In 1890, white supremacists, former white slaveholders, came back into power. They adopted a new state constitution. The primary focus of that constitutional debate was to figure out how to disenfranchise African Americans and to otherwise solidify the power of the white supremacists. And this is one way that they did this. They said, well, we're going to put into the state constitution, which is hard to change, that you have to have a 3/5 vote of both legislative houses in order to raise any taxes at all. And that provision is still on the books today and still making it harder to raise the revenue that's needed to make investments in poor black communities and in other communities of color in the state.
So just as in Britain, landowners have historically wielded almost all the political power and made sure they legislated for highly restrictive property tax limits. And in Alabama, that's also a very interesting example of where that is written into the Constitution, as you say, very difficult to change.
Yeah, the history here is similar to the history that I was just talking about in Mississippi. And so in Alabama, one form that took is to establish limits on how much property taxes could be increased. Some of the property tax limits that were put in place in that era are still on the books in several southern states, Alabama, Arkansas, Texas, a couple of others. They're still on the books today. And it's really undermined over a long period of time the ability of these states to raise the revenue needed for investments in communities of color and other low-income communities. So now Alabama still has the lowest property taxes per capita of any state in the country. Think about 150 years or so of that policy being in place and what the cumulative effect of that lack of investment and the privileges accorded to the landholders, who are still very, the value of landholding still disproportionately in white hands, what that's meant.
Yes, and why inheritance tax is so important.
Yes. One of the things that we know as policy analysts is that we know that white supremacy and structural racism created and continue to perpetuate disparities of power and resources. And an example of that is just thinking about who holds wealth in our country.
Right. And when it comes to questions about access to political power and who's involved in the making of legislation itself today, how representative are state legislatures of the citizens they serve in terms of demographics?
Still not very representative. For decades, state tax policy was written by almost entirely all white male legislators. Now, that's changed some over the last few decades, but still, African Americans are underrepresented in state legislatures, and other groups of color are even more underrepresented in state legislatures.
You know, we're recovering from many things. We're recovering from COVID-19. We're recovering from 400 years of oppression. And we are also recovering from a looming economic downturn. And one thing we know for sure and continue to learn with every economic downturn is that states have choices. They have a choice point, and that's to cut services and continue to cut their budgets that harm families that are in need, or raise revenue on corporations, raise revenue on those that are most profitable and the wealthy. And that's a racialized choice, given the country's history and ongoing biases.
Yes, I'm particularly interested about some of the really outrageous spends by some states in the United States on incentives for wealthy companies, large companies to set up in their states. And, you know, we've seen the competition for the Amazon headquarters where states were outbidding other states. And it's really bizarre because in some ways, some of those people would say it's very wrong. You mustn't give money to poor people who've been held back so long by the system. But they've got no problem with subsidizing wealthy corporations, and they shouldn't be offering tax breaks and economic development incentives.
Well, they can get a job at an Amazon fulfillment center. That's Naomi Fowler of the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network from the UK, obviously, interviewing three people, two from the Center for Budget Priorities. How does that go again? Center for Budget Policy Priorities, and a guy who does a podcast under the People's Tax Page. I think that's who we heard first. So I said I was going to try and play this short interview with Bustillo and a poem by Martin Espada without speeding Espada up too fast and without cutting anybody off. So we're going to get to this right now. I think I said a lot about this already, and okay, we'll just kick it.
Camilo, and yesterday there was pretty violent repression by both U.S. and Mexican authorities against a protest by Mexican asylum seekers in Matamoros. You want to talk about what was happening?
That would have been Tuesday.
Sure, and I think this is really the culmination of everything we've been talking about over the last few months and of the conditions that produced the tragedy that's reflected in Martin's extraordinary poem and the events behind it. What we saw yesterday was the beginning of a rebellion by the residents of the improvised refugee camp on the banks of the Rio Bravo on the Mexican side in Matamoros, that is the direct product of U.S. policy, which has essentially meant the negation of the right to asylum and the dismantling of the asylum system in the U.S. It's essentially impossible today to apply for asylum at the U.S. border. That began with the policies that led Oscar and Valeria to their death in the river. They turned to the river, that family, because there was no way for them to legally claim the asylum to which they were entitled, fleeing systemic and state violence in El Salvador, which is in turn the product, of course, of U.S. intervention in the 1980s in that bloody war. So I think what we have to understand is that the story that we're seeing today about the rebellion on the bridge of the residents of that camp, particularly the residents who are originally from Mexico, reflects their despair their indignation and their commitment to continue to struggle under completely impossible conditions for their most basic rights and recognition of their dignity as human beings. And that is why Oscar and Valeria went to their death. That's the story that Martin tells so extraordinarily and so powerfully in the poem we're going to hear shortly. And that's what we're marking a year later. At the same time, how did Trump observe the anniversary? Trump went to the border to worship at the foot of the wall that he's been, building up there, concretely at San Luis Rio Colorado near Yuma in southern Arizona, as we just heard from your previous participant so courageously. And what he did is, he signed the wall, right, left his signature behind, embraced it, and embodied it essentially as the symbol of all of the suffering that Oscar and Valeria's story also represents and echoes with, which is now shutting down the border in the name, supposedly, of public health, and claiming that it's migrants who are the source and the danger in terms of the virus, which is an extraordinary lie. Of course, this is an administration specialized in big lies. Well, this is one of the biggest ones. And of course, it started with the claims about the so-called Chinese virus and about the Kung flu, et cetera, which we just heard at his rallies in Tulsa and Phoenix. So, the same song continues, but the deaths continue also, and the struggle for dignity.
And the abject brutality is in itself a lesson to all of us. Comes with a cautionary tale and a bit of inspiration in terms of what we have to do to transform this world. I would like to bring you in, Martín Espada. Camilo was referring to the extraordinary poem you wrote, I guess it was a year ago yesterday, to remember these two Salvadoran migrants, father and daughter, who tragically drowned and were seen photographed after their drowning on the shores of the Rio Grande. You want to pick it up from there, Martín? What brought you into this?
Yes. What brought me into this were two factors. First of all, that photograph you mentioned was taken by Julia Leduc, a journalist for a Mexican publication, La Jornada, and it went viral. As you know, it appeared on the front page of the New York Times, it appeared on the Boston Globe, it appeared online everywhere. And it caused outrage, it caused grief, it also caused denial. There was a Facebook group called I'm 1015, a Border Patrol Facebook group, which featured an anonymous post that questioned whether or not that photograph was, in fact, doctored or staged. In other words, fake news. In other words, this was trutherism. And so my poem was a response to the drowning, was a response to the photograph, but in particular, a response to that post and that trutherism. So the poem takes its title from a term often used by the Border Patrol to describe those who have drowned crossing over. The poem is called Floaters. Epigraph. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and ask, have y'all ever seen floaters this clean? I'm not trying to be an ass, but I have never seen floaters like this. Could this be another edited photo? We've all seen the Dems and liberal parties do some pretty sick things. Anonymous post, I'm 1015, Border Patrol Facebook group. Like a beer bottle thrown into the river by a boy too drunk to cry. Like the shard of a styrofoam cup drained of coffee brown as the river. Like the plank of a fishing boat broken in half by the river, the dead float. And the dead have a name. Floaters, say the men of the Border Patrol, keeping watch all night by the river, hearts pumping coffee as they say the word floaters, soft as a bubble, hard as a shoe as it nudges the body to see if it breathes, to see if it moans, to see if it sits up and speaks. And the dead have names. A feast day parade of names. Names that dress all in red. Names that twirl skirts. Names that blow whistles. Names that shake rattles. Names that sing in praise of the saints. Say, Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez. Say, Angie Valeria Martinez Avalos. See how they rise off the tongue. The calling of bird to bird somewhere in the trees above our heads, chilling in the dark heart of the leaves. Say what we know of them now they are dead. Oscar slapped dough for pizza with oven-blistered fingers. Daughter Valeria sang, banging a toy guitar. He slipped free of the apron he wore in the blast of the oven, sold the motorcycle he would kick till it sputtered to life, counted off pesos for the journey across the river, and the last of his 25 years, and the last of her 23 months. There is another name that beats its wings in the heart of the trees. Say, Tania Vanessa Avalos, Oscar's wife and Valeria's mother, the witness, stumbling along the river. Now their names rise off her tongue. Say, Oscar y Valeria. He swam from Matamoros across the Brownsville. The girl slung around his neck, stood her in the weeds on the Texas side of the river, swore to return with her mother in hand, turning his back as fathers do, who later say, I turned around and she was gone. In the time it takes for a bird to hop from branch to branch, Valeria jumped in the river after her father. Maybe he called out her name as he swept her up from the river. Maybe the river drowned out his voice as the water swept them away. Tanya called out the names of the saints, but the saints drowse in the stupor of birds in the dark, their cages covered with blankets. The men of patrol would never hear their pleas for asylum, watching for floaters, hearts pumping coffee all night on the Texas side of the river. No one, they say, had ever seen floaters so clean. Oscar's black shirt yanked up to the armpits, Valeria's arm slung around her father's neck, even after the light left her eyes, both face down in the weeds back on the Mexican side of the river. Another edited photo. See how her head disappears in his shirt, the waterlogged diaper bunched in her pants, the blue of the blue cans. The radio warned us about the crisis actors we see at one school shooting after another. The man called Oscar Labrie, sit up, speak, tug the black shirt over his head, shower off the mud, and shake hands with the photographer. Yet, the floaters did not float down the Rio Grande like Olympians showing off the backstroke, nor did their souls float up to Dallas, land of rumored jobs, and a president shot in the head as he waved from his motorcade. No bubbles rose from their breath in the mud, light as the iridescent circles of soap that would fascinate a two-year-old. And the dead still had names. Names that sing in praise of the saints. Names that flower in blossoms of white. A cortege of names dressed all in black, trailing the coffins to the cemetery. Carve their names in headlines and gravestones they would never know in the kitchens of this cacophonous world. Enter their names in the book of names. Say Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez. Say Angie Valeria Martinez Avalos. Bury them in a corner of the cemetery named for the sainted Archbishop of the Poor, shot in the heart saying mass. Bullets bought by the taxes I paid when I worked as a bouncer and fractured my hand 40 years ago. And bumper stickers read, El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. When the last bubble of breath escapes the body, may the men who speak of floaters, who have never seen floaters this clean, float through the clouds to the heavens, where they paddle the air as they wait for the saint who flips through the keys on his ring like a drowsy janitor, till he fingers the key that turns the lock and shuts the gate on their babble-tongued faces, and they plunge back to earth, a shower of hailstones pelting the river, the Mexican side of the river.
Wow. That's Martina Spada reading his poem, The Floaters, to remember in memory of Oscar and Valeria. You may remember they drowned crossing the Rio Grande, part of U.S. foreign policy. And we thank you for that, Martina Spada, because we need the poetry to skip the brain sometimes and go right to the heart and then to the blood, and then maybe it becomes part of our intelligence. But those words, that poem, the memory of those two, and I do appreciate you calling it floaters, because that's what the U.S. government calls them, floaters.
Dennis Bernstein, a poet in his own right. Camila Perez Bustillo also on the beginning of that segment, and it's hard to compose myself. I will say that it's kind of good that the court ruling says that these incarcerated children by ICE should be released, but it's because of COVID, giving them another 3 weeks. If I recall, the Flores ruling should actually pertain, and I think it says that unaccompanied children shouldn't be incarcerated like that for less than 2 weeks. So 3 weeks is enough for them to enjoin the decision and continue the cruelty. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. Luckily, I have a script to read, so I can change my mood here. We thank you, listeners, for supporting WEFT. Parkland has a little underwriting announcement supporting their project READ. Nearly one in five adult Illinois residents struggled with basic reading, math, and English. Project READ helps hundreds in our communities learn these needed skills and reach educational goals. Homemakers, retirees, professionals, and college students volunteer as tutors and make a difference in others' lives. Project READ is now training new tutors and connecting learners with tutors. I think that means remotely. You can sign up online, and I think you can do the instruction online too. For more information, visit parkland.edu, Project READ. I'm not going to read out forward slash because you know that. All right, switching to, I'm reminding myself, to the other computer, which I didn't do successfully. I didn't preview Doug Henwood's feature, but it looks really good. He interviews a guy that I've read a bit and listened to some talks by. Previous interview from Pacifica. I think I did the announcement, but I'll do one again. WEFT Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sponsoring. Do what you can in the time of no work for many still. I said it was light on COVID. Maybe I'll do some more tomorrow. One thing I did note that applaud the Blackbird for doing the tracing info. Gave my phone number and my name so that if anybody who was there at the same time shows up with COVID, I'll be screened again.